You want us to go ahead in just a second.
I was wondering if I could go there, down there by Dallin.
Good morning, everyone. I'd like to call the January 29th meeting of the House Committee on Workforce and Economic Development to order and open an informational hearing on those topics. This morning, we're going to be talking about the influence of international trade on workforce development. This will be the concluding informational session, and we will be transitioning to hearing bills on Wednesday. Our first panel this morning consists of Doug Badger, Executive Director of the Pacific Northwest International Trade Association, as well as Walt Evans, Chair of the International Trade Committee. If you would, gentlemen, please, before you begin your individual testimony, introduce yourselves for the record, and I'll leave it up to you as to which order you go in. So welcome this morning. Thank you so much for making yourselves available for our committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, members of the committee, for having us. My name is Doug Badger, and I serve as the Executive Director of the Pacific Northwest International Trade Association. I'm going to keep my remarks relatively brief because I understand we want to leave a lot of time for questions, but I'll give you a little bit of background on PNEDA, talk a little bit about why Oregon is seen as an advantageous region from an export standpoint, and then give you some general statistics about volume of trade and our major trade trading partners. First of all, PNEDA has been around for close to 20 years. It is a trade association of member companies from around the Pacific Northwest who are heavily engaged in exporting goods and services to every corner of the world. PNEDA also has a seat on the Governor's International Trade Commission, so we participate through that on issues that are important to Oregon in terms of an international trade perspective. Oregon has many advantages from a trading standpoint. A lot of it comes down to our proximity to the Asian region. We have large maritime ports, Port of Vancouver, Port of Portland, who have robust businesses doing both export and import processing in and out of the Columbia River. And then we have a solid maritime industry up and down the Columbia with smaller ports in Umatilla, Pasco, and as far up river as Lewiston. We have rail service that connects from the ports of Portland, Tacoma, Seattle, all the way to the Midwest, which is a significant market for goods that are imported in the United States. So as a result, the Portland region is a significant jumping-off point for goods that are imported into the U.S., and our region serves as a distribution hub for the rest of the country. We sit on the axis of I-5 and I-84. So for people who distribute goods via surface transportation routes, we have excellent highways serving both east-west corridor, I-84, and I-5 north-south going from Vancouver all the way to Baja. So it's a very efficient location for both for water, rail, and surface transportation of goods. As a result, we've developed a pretty good expertise in just the distribution of goods being imported into the U.S. And that's not to mention the direct commercial air service that we have out of the Portland International Airport. We have 13 major cargo carriers that serve every market, European, Asian, Latin America, you name it. Some general trade statistics. In the year 2005, Oregon companies exported nearly $12.5 billion worth of goods and services to 183 foreign markets. That's a significant increase over the kind of the depths of the recession about 4 years ago. That's roughly a 30% increase in our export volume since the year 2001. So we've really turned the corner in terms of manufacturing goods for export and expanding our jobs base here. There are 4,754 Oregon companies that are currently exporting goods, That's a pretty significant number. And most importantly, about 87% of those are classified as small, medium-sized enterprises. So they're companies that are under the 500-employee threshold. You think of international trade sometimes as the sole province of large industry. But frankly, there's a lot of small and medium-sized enterprises in Oregon who are engaged in international trade. And again, 183 markets around the world. So very sophisticated in the markets they seek out. Our largest trading partner currently and has been for quite some time is Canada. We do about $2.3 billion worth of exports to Canada. Our balance of trade with Canada is about equal. We see imports of about the same value from Canada into Oregon. And again, we've seen that's our largest growth market, and that the volume of trade there has expanded by $1.1 billion. In the 2001 to 2005 time frame. So if you chart back to kind of when the recession started to today, we've seen considerable export volume increase to Canada. And I should note that that's true of a lot of our other trading partners, including our other NAFTA partner, Mexico, which saw over a $500 million trade volume increase in that same time frame. Given our proximity to Asia, it's no wonder that 10 of our top trading partners are either our NAFTA partners, Canada and Mexico, or Asian nations, primarily South Korea, China, Malaysia, Singapore. These are all large export markets for Oregon products. The only one in the top 10 that wouldn't fit in that China, Southeast Asia, or NAFTA partner category would be Australia, which is our 10th largest trading partner and sees quite a bit as well. Our biggest exports still today are dominated by agricultural crops. We export more than $2 billion worth of agricultural crops on an annual basis. And, of course, electronics and electronic equipment has surged as an export, and it rivals the agriculture commodities for volume of trade. Intel is a classic, obviously, within Oregon of manufacturing electronic componentry for export. I should note also that industrial and commercial equipment, lumber, wood products, transportation equipment, we have a considerable transportation equipment manufacturing base here in Oregon, and a lot of that is transported or exported. It's estimated that 1 in 4 jobs in the state of Oregon can be directly tied to international trade, either the manufacturing of it, secondary providers of manufactured goods for export, people in the transportation industry who are processing goods in and out of the country. And under that category, there are about 40,000 jobs that can be directly linked to Columbia River maritime commerce. And those jobs pay an average of about $47,000 a year. So good wages and a lot of jobs tied to the commerce coming in and out of our waterways. One quick note on foreign direct investment, and then I'll turn it over to my colleague, Walt. Foreign direct investment is a significant driver of employment here in Oregon as well. There's currently about 47,000 Oregonians whose jobs are directly linked to companies based outside of the country. So we've attracted a lot of capital here, and a lot of that has expanded our manufacturing base. And I should say nearly 11,000 of those jobs that are linked to foreign direct investment are in the manufacturing sector. So those are people who have set up manufacturing facilities here to produce. I'll stop there, and we can respond to questions. I'll just turn over to Walt, the workforce development piece.
Good morning. Sure. My name is Walt Evans. I'm a lawyer with Schwab, Williamson, and Wyatt.
Walt, excuse me. Walt, could you hold on just for a second? Representative Dahl.
Do we want to question Doug before we go on?
If you have a question that's important, certainly. Please.
Doug, you've tied three areas together that are very, very important to us in Eastern Oregon. One is exports, two is agriculture, and three is the people that might buy our agricultural products. We see, if I were to ask you for a prescription on how to get cattle out of Oregon, either in a box or on the hoof, what would you tell me to do?
Let me start. Give you time to think.
No, go ahead.
Well, I'd certainly, I'm not an expert in the livestock market. So if you would indulge me, maybe just talk a little bit more about the agricultural community more broadly, and maybe try to get into a specific commodity. I think to your point about rural Oregon, it's interesting when you talk about the urban-rural divide in the state of Oregon. The rural communities are among the most sophisticated international traders there are, particularly when you talk about investments in our transportation infrastructure. If there is one group that has been probably the most vocal, for instance, in terms of driving the policy of deepening the Columbia River Channel, it's been the agricultural community in eastern Oregon and eastern Washington. It's estimated that about 85% of the Oregon wheat is grown for export, and a significant business of the ports of Portland and Vancouver is the export of bulk commodities. A lot of it is things like wheat, a lot of it are minerals like soda ash. But the bulk commodity business is a big one, and they have noticed that the deepening of the channel will improve their abilities to attract ships and export their goods. The other commodity would be hay. I don't think people have an understanding of how much hay we export. A lot of it, you'd think we just sort of grow here, and it's used for feedstock, and it's consumed here either in-state or regionally. We export a significant amount of hay, and a lot of those go to Asian markets. It's trucked up on trucks to the Port of Portland, where sometimes they're put on rail cars and sent further up to the Port of Tacoma, and sometimes they're exported right out of the Port of Portland. So that's another business that's experienced a lot of growth, particularly in Asian markets. For livestock, I honestly can't give you a rock solid answer of how you would do that. I'd be happy to follow up with you. We work very closely with the Oregon Cattlemen, the Oregon Farm Bureau, and other agricultural producers. I think the one notable exception would be the nurseries, which are not heavily involved in international trade. They're more grown for domestic consumption, even though they're now the largest. At almost $900 million annually in their the amount of business they're doing.
Just curious, Representative Dahlem, is your district experiencing trade barriers for the export, or just market access?
We're having trouble. We want desperately to export cattle. We think we have them, and we think they're quality. We have a tough time getting them into China, into Japan, into Korea.
Uh-huh.
Those are the places we seem to. And I was looking for a recipe and a short answer, and then I would go do it. But apparently it was a little longer than that.
Well, just to put a finish on that, a lot of the issues that we confront from the agricultural side when you look at exporting are sanitary and phytosanitary barriers that are sometimes legitimate and sometimes not. They're sometimes employed as a protectionist measure against U.S. products. U.S. beef, for instance, has been kept out of European market for years because of fears of hormone use in U.S. fed cattle, even though the WTO has ruled that restriction to be illegal under the WTO agreements. They were still slow to let in our beef, and you can argue as to why that is, but we face those kinds of SPS barriers around the world.
Representative Barnhart?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. He said what I was going to say.
Okay. Thank you very much. Yes, Vice Chair Lim.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You mentioned that the 1 in 4 is related with the international trade. How did you come up with this 1 in 4? Sometimes this 1 in 4 number is very vague.
Mm-hmm.
And can you explain how did you come up with that 1 in 4?
I wish I could cite the source. I guess I would say that it's a figure that has been used by state of Oregon officials, the state of Washington, uses a figure 1 in 3 jobs that are directly linked to international trade. I'd be happy to follow up with you, but it's an issue that it's a statistic that we have heard from state officials, including OECD officials in the past.
So if you could provide some
sure.
background materials, yeah. I'd appreciate it.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you. Representative Holby.
Well, since we're into questions, I appreciate you being here on international trade. You know, earlier in this committee, there's been a lot of talk about the international trade actually are not being able to compete fairly with labor markets in other parts of the world because they have different standards of living, perhaps, or their wage requirements are non-existent. And, you know, we see a huge amount of jobs that are disappearing from Oregon or actually across the country because corporations can engage labor at far less cost in developing nations and other nations. And we're unable to compete fairly with those kinds of labor markets. Largely because you had mentioned the World Trade Organization having some impact on that, but yet they don't seem to be able to provide us with fair trade, as Representative Dahlem mentioned, with our beef. And so do you see the state of Oregon or the U.S. being able to address this unfair competition in labor markets, for example, to help maintain some of our jobs domestically?
Yeah, if I could maybe talk about that on two different levels. I think one thing that's interesting that I hear in talking to a lot of our members, it's not necessarily the cost of labor that they focus on, but the quality and supply of it. I know a couple of our major members that are participated in a congressional staff trip that we did last August were, you know, educating staff members on the importance of international trade, but also talking about how they have a difficult time recruiting and retaining qualified workers. And, you know, purely the type of people who will come into a manufacturing sector and, you know, dedicate themselves to that lifestyle for many years. They just have people they hire that walk off a job at lunch and they never hear from again. So they're constantly in the mode of trying to identify additional workers who are, again, just quality. On the trade agreement side, I think we've made significant progress in the area of labor, particularly over the last 15 years. You know, once upon a time, labor and environment were not required to be part of a trade agreement from an inside-the-text standpoint. When I mean inside-the-text, I mean a provision that's an actionable item under a dispute resolution process. NAFTA, for instance, had side agreements. They set up forums for people to discuss labor and environmental concerns of any of the three NAFTA partners. But there was no requirement that that those labor or environmental laws within the countries be enforced. When Trade Promotion Authority was negotiated and passed through Congress in 2002, it marked the first time when labor and environment provisions were required to be part of a trade agreement text. And the language required that any party to the trade agreement had to effectively enforce its own labor and environmental laws so as to not give themselves a trade advantage. In other words, the concern was that people would sort of look past labor requirements in order to give themselves a trade advantage. So that's now built into a text. It can be an actionable item under a trade agreement. And then separately from that, there have been millions of dollars that have flowed into sort of outside the text trade capacity building measures to help improve the labor conditions in certain markets so that the labor force there are given protections when it comes to some of the basic protections that are generally felt to be required of a workforce. So there has been significant improvement in that area, both inside the text and with trade capacity measures. And again, I come back to a lot of what I hear from our companies here is not necessarily that they're looking for the cheapest cost labor, but rather they're looking for quality labor.
Go ahead, Representative.
Follow up then. So in the case of Freightliner, for example, you're saying that they would move out of the country because their labor force isn't quality enough and it doesn't have anything to do with the cost of the labor in another country?
Well, in the case of Freightliner, everything that I've seen from the press and the trade press is that a lot of those job reductions are tied to what they view as a diminished demand for their product, due in large part due to new diesel emission requirements that are going to raise the cost of the product as those new engines are installed. And there was sort of a rush to get a lot of those products delivered prior to that implementation of that new requirement. So I think, you know, we need to be careful to look at any one particular instance of a company downsizing its workforce and link it directly to international trade when there's a lot of other components to it.
Vice Chair Riley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just to follow up on that, you know, it's nice for Freightliner to say that they're doing this because of the reduction in sales, at the same time building a new plant in Mexico. That doesn't really wash with me. It's easy to say what's politically correct, and maybe there is a downturn now, but they're not planning to come back to these workers in Portland. They're going to open a plant in Mexico. So, you know, what you just said is only a little bitty piece of what the reality is, and I'd like to hear your comments on that.
Well, I honestly don't know the facts of the Freightliner case other than what I've read in the newspaper. You may have, I don't want to expand beyond that other than there are always reasons, some market-driven, some other regulatory reasons, and sometimes it's a cost of labor. But in my experience, cost of labor is particularly on high-end manufacturing, something that's not necessarily the driver.
Thank you very much, Doug. Walter interrupted you right in mid-stride.
That's okay.
For the record, if you wouldn't mind, please introducing yourself again so that we have the flow of the record.
My name is Walt Evans. I'm a lawyer in a Portland law firm, Shaw, Williamson, and Wyatt. I chair the International Trade Committee of PANITA. There are three legs to the stool: trade policy, tax policy, and transportation policy. And if we were doing this at an all-day seminar, you all would understand why you need all three of those. We're not. I'm also on the board of a group called the International Sustainable Development Foundation, and I hope in the Q&A we're deeply involved in trying to open doors in China to teach sustainability and sustainability principles to Chinese officials. In my real world, I represent a number of ports, and so I'm know a fair amount about water transportation. I'm one of the Port of Vancouver lawyers, but in Oregon, I represent the Port of Umatilla, the Port of Morro, Pasco, Kennewick, all the way up to Lewiston. I'm doing some work for the Port of Coos Bay, and in smaller communities, ports are the economic engines that are the job creators around the state and have done a good job. Unlike my previous testimony before the legislature, I'm not going to give the seminar approach. I usually arrive with half an hour's worth of information in a 10-minute sack of time, so I'm not going to do that. I have basically a page and a half. But I can't resist doing one of the Evans handouts, and all I ask is that you please put this in your file that is entitled, Trade is Really Important to Oregon. And it'll be there for you as you get into this. The opening testimony may have been before Senator Lim's committee in 1990. I know I've testified before you, sir, and it's either heartening or terribly depressing that a number of the points I made in 1999 are still valid today. And I either apologize for that that we have not wrestled some of these issues to the ground. I have given speeches before the League of Women Voters, and they asked me to pull together my thoughts that I could leave with them as they studied several years ago the impact of international trade in Oregon. That testimony is attached. I've added some op-eds that I've written over the years, Engaging China the Oregon Way. There's some testimony I've given on channel deepening, which focuses on one of the points I want to leave with you today. I'd like to talk in the Q&A particularly about two elements. I love the name of this committee, Workforce Development, Workforce and Economic Development, because if I may be allowed one sports cliche in Super Bowl week, you folks already are on the 50-yard line. You get it. You understand this nexus. And not everyone in the building and not everyone in the state has made that connection, and you are there, so your job is... You can play a unique role. The second thing I hope we have a chance to talk about is the role of an efficient transportation system. If you talk to your constituents who are trying to trade, who are trading now, they will stress the fact that traffic delays are costing them in the what's called either the last mile or the last 5 miles as you're trying to get to the docks off of the railroad or off of the freeway. Money is lost, and the ability of those products to compete internationally can be squandered. There's one Oregon company that had made 3 round trips between the docks and their factory every day, and the traffic has now squeezed that to 2 round trips. Well, that's a real reduction in efficiency and a real reduction in their ability to compete. One of the things in the workforce development that on the back page of my testimony I've talked about is trade adjustment assistance. That's a federal program, but it is an element in helping prepare our workforce for the 21st century. And I have had clients who have applied. I've helped them. Some have been granted, some have not been granted TAA, as it's called. But I also want to say that the state plays a role. The state and community colleges play a role in administering the training programs. And the people that work for the state of Oregon, Bev Malone and her team in the Department of Employment, are terrific public servants. They are they're a joy for me to deal with, and they've answered a lot of questions over the years. Now, how does a state legislative committee want to involve itself with a federal program? And I hope we can talk a little bit about that in the Q&A. Critics of trade sometimes cite the number of people who've applied for TAA as a part of their argument that trade isn't working. You know, we've had a gazillion people apply for TAA, and it is a big number. But I'd like to switch it around and talk about the benefits of these training programs, but how they can become more efficient. But I want to say that no abstract discussion of getting people a new job is a substitute for having a job. And if you don't have a job, whatever I say or whatever we say collectively is hard to understand for somebody who is not working. And I tend to want to get into the abstractions, and I always need to sort of ground it on the right to a job, the opportunity to work, a place to live, are sort of where it all begins. So as a founding board member of the International Sustainable Development Foundation, we may be able to talk about how we are branding Oregon as the home of sustainable development, particularly in China. Now, our little elevator speech says we want to make Portland the Geneva of sustainability. But there's a lot of paper shuffling in Geneva, and it's a lot of bureaucrats opining with other bureaucrats, and that's not what we're trying to do. We want to create export opportunities, and those are environmental goods and services, and we want to have Portland be the funnel, the broadcast
to China for opportunities to export our environmental goods and services. When the session adjourns at the end of the year, I'll close my comments. I want you to look back and know that your service on this committee has left a legacy, solidifying Oregon's ability to compete in the international arena while strengthening workforce training programs. I hope you're able to do that. That would be something to mark this committee. I don't think it's a partisan issue. Everybody cares about these subjects. And that's, you've got something that you can do. Your employees, we want your employees to, our employees in Oregon, to be known as men and women who both can outcompete and outsmart our competitors. And that's not too high. I mean, I believe in raising the bar. As one of my friends said, your goal should always outpace your reach. Doug and I and Panita would like to work with you throughout the session. If you need somebody to bounce ideas off of, we've both been around long enough that, and I'm not a partisan guy. I see this committee as offering an opportunity to make some progress in some critical issues. That concludes my testimony. I'm happy to answer any questions. Would you like me to start with the beef? I had one other thing to add.
Please, that would be.
I don't want to. But Doug did a great job. I'm going to give you a slightly different answer. We can export what our foreign customers want, and the first step is to make sure you're not. And I mean any of us are not trying to export a square peg in a world that wants round holes. There was an Oregon company, and this is not the complete answer, that saw in Japan an opportunity to grow and export what we'll call Kobe-like beef, the heavily marbled beef. And I don't know that they still have that market. They've developed it for the Japanese restaurants in the Pacific Northwest. But the thinking that went on was not what can we export, but what do our overseas customers want to buy from us. And I think that would be, sir, the first step for your constituents would be to talk to the folks in the Foreign Agricultural Service and find out in Thailand and Vietnam what it is that they are looking for. And it is to focus on a value-added niche. Oregon's opportunities will be less in areas where we can compete in the commodities and more where we can compete in the value added. Kobe beef is just one. And turning to Freightliner, I'm happy that Doug got the tough question. As I understand it, what Freightliner is going to do in Portland is to move to a higher cost, higher value truck. It will employ fewer workers, and I don't want to minimize the impact that is fresh in everybody's minds of the decision to close production of what they were doing. But they, as I understand it, and I've only read the newspaper clippings as well, they will produce a higher cost truck that to them makes sense to still manufacture. It doesn't answer the number of employees, but that is sort of, if you were to look at where the state can grow, it is in the value added area. So we're happy to answer questions.
Thank you very much. I think Representative Barnhart.
Well, on that very last point, what that does mean, of course, is that there's an opportunity for some other manufacturers to come in and snap up some very experienced workers who understand how to do manufacturing at a high-quality level. So the things that are negative may also have some positive long-term effects if we get out there and get to work on finding that manufacturer.
Yeah, and to me that really speaks to the business community and state agencies really needing to work together to identify those needs. I mean, just this isn't export related, but it was just announced that Oregon Iron Works was given a contract to manufacture the streetcars for you know, a couple dozen cities around the country who are beginning to implement a streetcar type of system. That's going to require additional workers to manufacture those, and it seems like a real opportunity to help connect some of these employees who are going to find themselves displaced with employers who are ramping up production in other areas.
And the question, if I may, isn't it a fact that in the global economy that we find ourselves, that being nimble has a huge advantage? And nimbleness means not being afraid to close down something that isn't working anymore while starting up something else that is. I mean, that seems like a truism to me, but maybe you have a comment about it.
There's an exaggerated example that I used to use, and that is that if people saw the internal combustion engine as a threat to the horse and buggy, we might still be trying to protect the buggy whip manufacturers. And sometimes you have to face a hard decision that if the competition isn't just coming from the low end, but it is moved up the scale, that this may not be a product or a process that anybody in Oregon can compete in continuing to produce. So there's always a transition, but the nimbleness, there is no substitute for being nimble and responding to changes in what the market wants. And whether it's if you're an apparel manufacturer that and you're importing that apparel, you can still have the fashion sense, or the, if it's an athletic manufacturer or somebody, the ability to get a product to market quickly, and the ability to negotiate and understand the trade barriers, the trade facilitation measures that can help effectuate that.
Representative Dahl.
I'll tell you, we've heard testimony about jobs and preparation to the point that we want to bring those people that prepare people for the world of work together. It seems to me in international trade that one of the things that you should have is the ability to talk to your trading partner. How do we stack up when it comes to our workers, our people that market our goods, communicating with South Korea, China? Do we know their language? Do we have people readily available that can step in and converse with the Japanese?
I have an answer. Do you want to be thinking of yours?
Sure.
Go ahead. I'll stumble, and then Doug will be glib and very persuasive. We do not teach enough foreign languages in our schools. It is often an impediment. One of the things I said in my statement, when I practiced law in D.C., one of my clients was the Embassy of Japan. And one of the very thoughtful ambassadors, it was on his watch that he took me to lunch and wanted to talk about what could be done to get more American students to study in Japan. He said this is an embarrassing imbalance, and it has some long-range consequences. American universities are welcoming to Japanese students. We want Japanese universities to be welcoming to American students. We need to promote more Japanese language skills, and part of that would be understanding a culture by living in it. And any of your young people in the high schools that have been overseas on a summer program will come back and share with you stories about how they've learned the culture. The other story pertaining to language is that a high-tech executive was in India dealing with a co-venturer, and they were launching a venture, and the Indian official said, oh, by the way, I don't know how to tell you this, but while my older child learned English as a second language, my younger child is learning Chinese as a second language. That's not to say that English isn't still the language of business around the world, but the ability to not just have the book learning, but to understand the benefits of cross-culturalization. The Oregon has been a leader, and it started with Japan, in exchanging high school wrestling teams, exchanging musical groups. That came into the house, they would stay with their counterparts, and these are wonderful opportunities, and they go back understanding a culture. That's not a substitute for the immersion programs in Portland that I have heard about have been a big success. There's a Japanese school in Eugene, as I recall. There's
correct.
An immersion program.
Yes, there is.
Those are training those young people to be, they're starting off better equipped to compete. The consul general who was here from Japan recently came back from a visit to one of the Japanese immersion schools, I think it was the one in Eugene, impressed with what he had seen and impressed that it wasn't just the classroom, but it was, we want to learn more, and they were requesting some of the cultural tours that the Japanese government arranges in the U.S. They wanted these folks to come to visit their school.
If I could, it's a great response, and let me just focus a little bit more on government resources, because I think one thing, when I heard your question, it's a little bit of, and this ties in a little bit to Representative Barnhart, how nimble are we in identifying markets and helping a small Oregon manufacturer or a small service provider find that niche and get into it? And the answer is there's an extraordinary amount of resources that are available to people at the state, federal, and NGO level to help do that translation and get into these markets. I think more than people really recognize, and I think sometimes you think about, you know, the federal government or the state government, people are a little overwhelmed and don't know necessarily where to plug in. But the state, just starting with them, the OECDD has a fantastic international operation run by Karen Godden, who was formerly head of PNEDA, and has a real understanding of the international trade world in Oregon and connecting it to overseas markets. So she's a fantastic resource. The federal government, the Department of Commerce, has an export assistance office located in Portland that's run by Karen's husband, Scott Godden. And he has a team of incredibly sophisticated people, most of whom have lived in countries where they are now asked to be experts, and have lots of contacts on the ground, not only in other agencies, but also in the business community to help with distribution. Certainly there's investment restrictions people need to know about. The Department of Agriculture has a Foreign Agricultural Service. They've got an Agricultural Marketing Service. Both of those are aimed at helping ag producers find those markets and get into them. And then on the NGO side, I'll just throw one example. Andy Anderson, who's the former head of the Oregon Farm Bureau, now runs the Western States State Agricultural Department Association. And one of their big objectives is to help growers in the West find their way into foreign markets, working with the State Departments of Agriculture, who have programs to help on the export side. So I think if people were to start asking about where they can find help to get into other markets, they can certainly start with us and we can help them. But there's a tremendous number of resources out there to help our exporters.
I agree. And both the state and the federal government have well-equipped staff. Their publications, at a more fundamental level, people will come to me and say, my company makes widgets and I'd like to try and export them. And if they come to you, they've come to me because I'm a lawyer and they think they should start there. And I actually say, I'm third in line. Go. Have you figured out in meetings with your banker that you can get paid? Because if you can't get paid, if there's not a way for you to get your money and your profits back, this is a non-starter. So start with the banker. The second person is to start with they used to be called customs brokers and freight forwarders. Now they are logistics managers. How are you going to get your widget into Vietnam to get it into the hands of your customer? How long is it going to be on the ocean? Will it go in a container? Will you be shipping less than a container? You need someone to give you some answers to those questions so that you know. And then come and see a lawyer who can help you make sure that your intellectual property is protected, that you've got the corporate structure that you're filling out. I used to do a fair amount of export licensing in D.C., and with the growth in technology, you can violate export regulations innocently now by taking your high-tech widget with your laptop and going off to certain countries and participating in a trade show. You don't plan to do that, but they can surprise you. So at a fundamental level, what I'm saying is make sure that the companies can compete. Occasionally people come to us and they say, we need to start exporting because we're facing more competition. Well, if the competition comes from a Boise company or a Minneapolis company, that's great. But if the competition comes from an Australian company, you probably can't export your widget to Australia. But they may not grasp that.
Thank you very much for that. And for the benefit of our Internet audience, and some of whom may have questions about export trade and would like a point of entry, we would like to be able to assist anyone possible. Panita, I think, may be one point of entry for folks. And if you wouldn't mind giving a phone number to answer any questions, we might appreciate that.
Sure. The Panita number is 503-260-3235.
Thank you very much. And our committee administrator, Ellen Osenak, has also volunteered to be a point of entry for anyone who has questions for needing assistance with the state of Oregon. Ellen, if you'd please give your phone number.
My direct line is 503-986-1659.
Thank you very much. Representative Holby, you had a question or a comment?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. You know, I just don't want to beleaguer this point, but, you know, I want to go back, and I really appreciate the comments Mr. Evans made about, you know, investing in education and getting some more language in our schools and things. I think that's absolutely critical to international trade, that we be able to communicate on their terms as well. But, you know, and back to Representatives Barnhart's comments and your response to, you know, the nimbleness being an opportunity if the state and the businesses can operate fast enough to make sure we have opportunities for those displaced workers. At sometimes I might suggest that these workers themselves are probably much more nimble and they're not going to wait around for, you know, a new job. They're without jobs. They're going to go find someplace else to work. And so my question evolves around that as we look at helping companies go forward, and we want to make investments to help them more competitive, which you're suggesting. Should we be investing our workforce dollars and economic development dollars in companies like Freightliner who do not guarantee us that they're going to keep their workforce here?
Sure. I'm not going to touch the Freightliner example. Instead, I'm going to talk a bit. The one thing I wanted to talk about, this gives me an opportunity to get to trade adjustment assistance. That's a program set up for workers, and I agree with you completely. The companies that I have helped file trade adjustment assistance consider their workers their most important assets. I didn't. If I had had more time, I probably would have asked permission of a couple of clients to tell their story, because they went through these periods, this furloughing workers or closing production, as a very difficult decision. And in one case, they were the last remaining American workers who made this particular product. And how you invest dollars, I'm not sure about the wisdom of investing in a particular company to save a particular company. I'm on the board of a Commerce Department panel, Trade Adjustment Assistance Center, and unlike trade adjustment assistance that I'll talk about for the workers, there's 50% money that is made available to a company that wants to put up 50%, where you face import competition and you have to retune what you do to stay in business. And it's usually done to hire, the money spent to hire a consultant. And the poster child, and this is not an Oregon example, is a company that made baseball caps, and they were losing their market to imported baseball caps. So I think you can get $50,000 or $100,000. You match it. You have to match it. And they are now a successful company making old-fashioned period baseball caps that instead of charging $5.99 or $9.99, they can charge $29.99 for something that says Boston Red Stockings. That's an old 1919 hat. On the company side, you have to start that early enough. For trade adjustment assistance, the company can apply, but a group of workers can apply, and moving quickly is an absolute necessity. The Labor Department will get you an answer in fairly quick fashion on whether your workers qualify or not. The Trade Adjustment Assistance Program has been broadened so that it covers longer period, more training. There's a health insurance component. And the same law in 2002 actually created a farmer trade adjustment assistance, and I've just told you all I know about it, the farmer program. I wrote down I've never had a client ask about it. If I were looking for you to integrate some of the trade adjustment assistance, now this is after the fact, and we can come back to how you anticipate it, how you modernize. You want to keep these jobs, and I don't want to minimize that. But if a decision has been made, tell your constituents, a group of up to three, over three of them, if it's a decent size, or 10% of the workers that are furloughed can file the petition, but you hope the company steps up and has already talked to the lawyers and talked to the state and talked to the feds about how to do it. So the first thing I would suggest to strengthen how this committee interacts with Trade Adjustment Assistance, a federal program, get the companies that tell you that they're going to have to do this. Your first words out of your mouth should be, have you already started the filing for trade adjustment assistance? Where are you on that? What are you going to do to help your workers? Secondly, get the staff from the state and the community colleges to come in and say, what is there about this program that you would like to change? What should we be talking to the members of the Oregon delegation, as we're the local elected officials? We want the money that is spent at the state level to be spent as efficiently as we can. What do you need to be done better? And we'll take that message to the delegation. I'll end on that one. Tell Congress to increase trade adjustments funding levels. It's not funded enough. This is not a partisan issue. If I may put on a partisan hat, if you want to say that Democrats have more questions about liberal trade than Republicans, I want to say to the Republicans, if you support an open trading system, you have to support a robust trade adjustment system, or it's to heck with the workers and nobody should want to be in that position. So a robust assistance program for worker retraining is part of this equation of how we develop a national trade policy. Understand the number of people that apply have been used by critics of trade adjustment assistance. There's a number, and it's 12,000 or 15,000. Well, or 18,000, or 28,000, 38,000, whatever it is, that shows that trade isn't working. Three quick observations. One is, not a lot of those people qualify, because if you look at the number that qualify, because these, in order, trade adjustment assistance, you have to make a good or a product. It's not service, and the numbers can get fuzzy. Secondly, these are people who are taking advantage of a program to train. And third, we should be doing a better job creating a pipeline at the end of that training with exporters. And the comment that I'd make to you is that when you meet with your exporters, it is fair for you to say, are you trying to hire new workers that have come from the training programs for trade adjustment assistance? The last one, and this is a hot potato, and so I'm going to save it for last, is there is an effort to expand trade adjustment assistance to cover service workers. And I thought it sounded like a good idea, and I mentioned it to one of my friends in D.C. who said, I will caution you that some of the critics will tell you that that just makes it easier for service companies to move their businesses offshore. But it is a legitimate topic for you to consider whether that makes sense or doesn't make sense. I'm not going to get into the details. Doug, you want to?
Representative Holby.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just to follow up on that, I appreciate your comments about the trade adjustment assistance. It sounds like it is a great program. I know many who have utilized that. But I don't know that you really answered my question. Specifically before we get to a case where we have to consider the trade assistance program, should the state, when it goes to invest its tax dollars and its revenues, in particular companies for workforce or economic development, should we have some sort of requirement so that we can guarantee we're getting a return on our investment, that they provide a certain number of jobs for a certain length of time at a certain pay rate, and if they do not, we get that money back?
Since I'm not speaking for PNEDA, I'll say yes. I'm not sure that it's the best use of state resources to invest in a specific company anyway. But if you develop programs for industry assistance or programs in which a company is, any one of a number of companies applies, it is fair for you as people who husband state resources to say these are the benchmarks for a company that chooses to participate. And we are, this is the public's money. Mm-hmm. And we are going to protect that investment that we are going to make. So I'm sorry, I meant to come back to that. Personally, I didn't support that Chrysler bailout many years ago. It seemed to work, so I'm not going to say it didn't work. But I'm not sure about writing a check to a company. But I think you meant something slightly broader. If it's a program in which a variety of companies can participate, that's great, and I think you should. But it is, you don't want to just turn over a blank check or rely on the good intentions. As your hero Ronald Reagan once said, trust but verify. We all can use that.
Oh, line. Thank you for quoting my hero.
Good.
Thank you. You answered my question.
Representative Gerard, who's up down there in quarantine.
Yeah, I'm going to try to give you a softball question here. You talked about three legs to your stool. We've kind of gone over one of them pretty elaborately. The other one that caught my attention was the transportation problems. Could you elaborate as to what I know you want to see it improved,
Obviously, it's going to take some capital to do that. Do you have any suggestions where that might come from? One suggestion I've always heard is a tri-county increase in the gas tax, or could you elaborate on what you want to see and how we get there?
Let me start by what we want to see, and I should say that PNEDA tends to focus its efforts at the federal level, although we've been asked questions about state funding as well. Generally speaking, our objective is to improve freight mobility in and out of Oregon when it comes to transportation. So in maritime industry, that means channel deepening project. It means ensuring that there is dredging maintenance in the Willamette River. It means that there is maintenance of the jetties at the mouth of the Columbia. All of those things are critical if we're going to have the ability to get Eastern Oregon wheat or any imports that are coming in free-flowing, and also, I should say, compete with ports like Tacoma and Seattle that are deep-water ports that can attract a larger vessel. On the surface transportation side, it means making sure that the I-5 and I-84 corridors are improved so that there is efficient freight mobility in and out of, or I should say through. I mean, a lot of what the I-5 is a trade corridor. It's goods that are coming into the Port of Portland that are being shipped out, but it's also goods that are just traveling through. So from a regional asset standpoint, it's a critical issue. On that, there is a discussion about what we're going to do with the Columbia River crossing. Certainly, that's an issue that we as an organization have been following closely. It's now getting into the draft EIS state process, and there are three alternatives on the table for discussion. Both the Oregon Department of Transportation and the Washington Department of Transportation have requested $5 million each from Congress to make sure that there's adequate funding for the EIS. We support that. We're going to help them advocate that money get back here so that process continues, because anybody who's traveled over the I-5 bridge knows that the number of hours that it's congested is increasing. So both of those issues are things that we follow carefully. The last thing is rail investments. I think particularly anybody who has a rural concern has heard increasing voices of people who are concerned about efficient and reliable rail transportation short haul. So people from who are trying to transport a good via rail from within Oregon or Washington to one of the regional ports. There's an increasing pressure on the system to allow for those cars to be available to our producers who need to get something to port. And that's something that we continue to advocate, that there be efficient and reliable transportation short-haul rail. How we get there, again, we tend to advocate more for federal resources. That's certainly going to be a big component of the I-5 bridge. We have a well positioned now with some of our Oregon members and Washington State members who are in a position to deliver federal funds for that project. Congressman DeFazio was extremely helpful in earmarking funds within the last highway bill for I-5 improvements. So those are things that we're going to continue to advocate for. But I know separately there's a very robust discussion going on within the business community here about how much money is needed for transportation investments within the state and where we go to get that money. I'm not prepared to speak on that today, but I know it's a huge issue is where you find the money.
I'm prepared to say, because I can speak for myself, that I think a gas tax increase, I mean, we are seeing now the price of oil go down. It's $55 a barrel. And one of the problems you have in advising clients who are making investments is stability. And as this goes up and down, we're generally in a period of scarcity for gas. And I'm okay with a gas tax increase because it will provide the long-term stability. And just as we saw when the oil price per barrel went up and was so painful, I'm okay personally with that. I think it ought to stay on the table. Secondly, within this committee, I hope you all join the Transportation Committee members at the hip so that you can badger them that an efficient transportation system is one of the arms of trade competitiveness that you all can do something about. It is a benefit that doesn't always get measured. I have testified, and I've used the corny saying, that freight doesn't vote, but the workers do vote. And so there is a constituency for efficiency in freight mobility. And we are part of that constituency, and we're here to say today that we will help you. But in this building, please use your clout, use your persuasion, whatever it takes to be in the table, be in the room and at the table when the legislature later in the session is going to be making some decisions, because they need to hear and they need to consider just the points that you're going to be looking at as on this committee.
Vice Chair Lynn.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. As we are talking about the mobility of the freight from the Columbia, from the ocean to Portland, it's going to take about 7 hours to come in, 7 hours to go out. So we are losing about 14 hours, and plus Columbia deep channeling and also environmental concerns. And do you see sometime in the future in our state we need all the additional ports such as Astoria, maybe Coos Bay, access from the ocean directly, as you know, Tacoma, Seattle, San Francisco, Long Beach, they are near the ocean, save a lot of times and money, and ours is not. And the boat is getting bigger and bigger. I'm not sure whether we can accommodate the boat coming in this Columbia River. What is the long view assessment of this issue? If you have any.
Mr. Walter, I can.
Okay. Our firm represents the steamship operators, so I'm not speaking for them. I'm speaking for myself. And one of my partners is president of the Port of Portland Commission. My grandfather was a lawyer in Portland early in this century, and he and his pals talked about Portland versus Astoria. And I have seen that deflect discussions over how to strengthen Portland-Vancouver as a hub. The infrastructure in Astoria that would be we looked at this in part when the channel deepening was proposed. And in order for, if you take the number of lanes of road and the amount of warehousing that would have to be done, no one's prepared to pave over Young's Bay and those wetlands out to Fort Clatsop to provide the background, the shoreside infrastructure. It would lessen the upriver trip. The river pilots have always been interested. They've been supporting channel deepening, and the longshoremen in Portland and Vancouver, the ones that I'm familiar with, I know less about Calam on Longview, but the longshoremen understand that they need to be productive and that they want to, that their productivity is when we get back to the transportation, that's another element of it. So decisions were made to deepen the Columbia a long time ago, and my worry would be that if we were to sort of reopen that was done 6 or 8 or 10 years ago, when the people in Astoria, Clatsop County, were saying, shouldn't this be an option? And my view is that we're too far along, and that Portland, Portland offers certain opportunities. How would you get onto rail? How would you get on? What kind of freeway connections in and out of Astoria? That my personal view is that time has passed, and when it comes up, and Betsy Johnson is a friend, and if she were sitting in this committee, I would be I probably told her the same thing, that I think that Astoria has even made some local decisions to pull up rail tracks. They're looking at a future as a different kind of port, as more of an economic incubator, economic investment hub there.
Gentlemen, you've talked a good deal about the importance of freight mobility and efficiencies. I think oftentimes when we're confronted with security measures in our port system, we view that challenge as a problem. And I'm wondering if there's an opportunity to see that challenge as an opportunity, to see it as something that could be a potential for further economic development. Would you comment on that, please?
I think absolutely. I mean, there are certainly companies in the Pacific Northwest that have products that are aimed at the homeland security sector, and in particular can be deployed on screening cargo, for instance. So from an economic development standpoint, I think it's an area that the state of Oregon should focus a little bit more on in terms of maybe trying to develop that as a cluster, because there is a lot of human and industrial content here. The flip side of that, and I think one thing that we run into at the federal level, are mandates for 100% cargo screening, for instance, by a date certain, that may not be achievable. I think the concern is that there are so many steps in the chain when you're talking about a distribution of a good from anywhere in the world to the United States, that it's you run the real risk of stacking goods back just so that you can get into this screening process. There are ways to do it, and I think the private sector is working very closely with the freight folks now to accomplish that. So from the standpoint of making sure that cargo coming in, I think everybody has a stake in making sure that it's screened, but working closely with the private sector to make sure that that gets done. From an economic development standpoint, I know for a fact there are companies here who want to get more into that sector, and it would be a great opportunity.
I would add that, coming back to Representative Lim's, you also included Coos Bay. They are a client. Coos Bay has rail out on the North Spit, and they could offer to a company, if we went to inspect every box, the congestion at L.A. Long Beach is something that is driving a lot of decisions down there for companies to decide whether that's where they want to maintain all their business, and think about what that would be like. So that would involve an opportunity for a port such as Coos Bay, Grace Harbor perhaps, where you have rail adjacent to water, where you could take imports and inspect the boxes, and your competitive advantage would be that the inspection could be done easily and rapidly, whereas I think the hope in L.A. Long Beach is that they're going to push this inspection off to Hong Kong, off to Singapore, so it doesn't have to get done here. There'd be some kind of a certification. Right now the big decision is over the ID cards. But there will be legislation introduced in the Congress for 100% box screening this Congress.
Walt, I know you mentioned the importance of transportation and specifically pointed out the importance close at the docks. And I suspect that our need to increase our efficiencies relative to port security measures is actually going to drive overall redesign, work reorganization,
transportation development at the port docks, and frankly, what we have viewed as a problem, being able to pass both passengers and cargo through the security measures, may actually be the driver that leads to additional efficiencies that we probably should have had years ago.
I hope you repeat that every chance you get, because you need that perspective that's not always there, because the grumbling and the complaining, and that sometimes comes when we're too far down the road where it's been imposed and we're struggling with it. So how can the maritime community, the business community, the longshoremen, how can they figure out more efficient ways to do business that will have to comply with whatever Homeland Security requirements are there? But can we do it better? Can we do it faster? And if we can, business will follow.
If I could just piggyback on that, I think one of the things is, you know, we talk about the opportunity that exists due to the congestion at other West Coast ports like Long Beach, and the fact that it's a huge market to begin with, but a lot of the reasons goods go into a port like that is the travel time doesn't exist up and down the Columbia Rivers. So if there's a way that we can work together to squeeze the time of processing in and out of a port like Portland, for instance, and begin to erase a little bit of that gap between what somebody might experience in terms of their security requirements at Long Beach, not to mention just the stacked ships that get stacked up there due to the congestion. Then you're in a situation where you're talking about a competitive advantage as opposed to a disadvantage. So I think working together to identify where those efficiencies can take place, implementing them, and then marketing as a real alternative to one of the other ports is the way to go.
Gentlemen, thank you so very, very much for your excellent testimony today. And my encouragement back to both of you, the more that we can promote sustainability, the better off we will be in all of our endeavors. Again, thank you so very, very much.
We're on call if you need to follow up, and Ellen knows where to find us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Bobby Lee. Our next witness is Bobby Lee, Communications Director for Strategic Planning Department for Hynix Semiconductor. Mr. Lee, good morning.
Good morning.
Welcome.
Thank you very much, Chairman Witt and members of the committee. My name is Bobby Lee. I'm with a company called Hynix Semiconductor. Hynix Semiconductor is the second largest semiconductor in the world. We make memory chips. And I think you all know what a memory chip is. I don't go into any science jargon about that. But certainly, our company is a rival to Eugene, Paul Hovey's district, actually, has really diversified the local economy in Eugene. It really indicates that the world is changing from an agricultural-based economy to a service-based economy, now entering into the digital economy. The sign that our company, which is headquartered in South Korea, arriving to the United States, so it's counterintuitive with the kind of discussions that you had earlier about companies here going to other places. And I've been asked that question a lot. I'm assuming that's part of the question here tonight or today. Our company is about 1,200 employees. Average wage is about $43,000 a year. If you combine the benefits, it's about $73,000 a year. By far, we're the largest taxpayer in Eugene. You can combine the next 9 businesses, and we'll be paying more taxes, even with the Enterprise Zone program. We hire 70% from the local area, the metropolitan Eugene-Springfield area, and 90% from Oregon. And so we hire locally, and that's our commitment to the state of Oregon. Our company is making high-end memory chips. Now, memory chips are no different from pizzas. There's so many different kind of pizzas out there. But what we make is the premium kind of pizza, the stuff that everyone wants. And the reason why we make the high-end is because our target market is servers. And servers have to be, as you all know, that's sort of the brain of the whole IT system. It has to be consistent. Any breakdown in the server can really affect your emergency services, hospitals, universities, and so on and so forth. So we make the high-end, perfect memories, and we make the most cutting-edge versions. With that, I'll just open it up. I can just go on forever and forever with these things because I love it too. But if you have any questions, I'll go ahead and open it up, and we can start from there, Chairman.
Vice Chair Riley, thank you so much.
Thank you very much, and welcome back to the Capitol.
Thank you. Good to be back.
One question. What brought your company to Oregon, and why are you here?
Right. The high-tech companies tend to be internationally based. And when you put all your eggs in one location, if you will, such as China or in South Korea, and take into consideration nuclear war issues or international politics or government instability in a certain country, it is unwise to put all your eggs in one basket. People have high prospects about China, but no one really has a crystal ball. And you have to diversify in order to compete in the new economy. In other words, you have to have contingency plans. You have to have a system, support system, rather than one area where you just invest all your future investments. So we tend to diversify, and other companies are no different, Samsung, Intel, so on and so forth. And so we have plants in China, in South Korea, and United States. If something happens that's diminishing the return in one area, other places can pick it up. So you have a system of support system in place.
Follow up, Vice Chair Riley.
Thank you. More specifically, why did you choose Oregon?
There's certainly the enterprise zone played a role, although compared to China, it's a pretty small amount of subsidy.
Mm-hmm.
The workforce played a tremendous role. We could have, I suppose, located in Washington County, for example, with Intel and other high-tech companies.
I wish you had.
I'm glad you did.
Yeah. but having University of Oregon, LCC certainly played a tremendous role. The price of land, the price of water, the price of power, all those things played a significant role. Now, some people also argue the tax issue with the sales tax. But overall, buying land, if you were to compare Korea, South Korea, and Eugene, Oregon, the price of land, I mean, it's just so much cheaper. The cost of living in general is just so much cheaper here. So we can make a higher impact to our workforce when we give them good salary. It really makes a difference in the local economy. And so all those things played a role. There really is, I don't think, a silver bullet that
okay.
It changes everything.
Thank you.
Sorry.
Other questions? Yes, Vice Chair Lim.
Welcome back again.
Thank you.
And as you know, he was my chief of staff last session, mm-hmm. and he's making 10 times more than before.
Naturally. We hope.
And some time ago, I heard you had a plan, the second phase, building it. What is the plan now? Do you have any plan to build a second, the facility, or that is gone now?
You know, thank you, Representative Lemon. It's good to be back, and you've done a lot of work on behalf of this company, and I appreciate that. It's still unknown, and the number one reason is because, in part, the election of South Korea, presidential election cycle, is also in play. The second is the economy, the market around semiconductor market is changing, is shifting again, in part because of iPod, I might add, and also Vistas, the new Microsoft operating. So we have to sort of watch how that plays out and see what happens down the road. Our company is hoping to expand, it may not necessarily be here in Oregon, but it's still unknown. I think this year is a critical year for us. I know that the governor and we have some staff members that also came to Karen. We traveled out to South Korea last year and was trying to build a relationship with our company headquarters in order to make sure that Oregon is getting its fair share. But there are some synergistic issues. When you have research involved located in the same location as your manufacturing, there are some benefits to that that also have to be considered. So it all depends on the market, and at this point, we're in transition. And I just don't know if anyone really knows what's going to happen in the next few years. But this will be a critical year. We'll be sure to let you know.
Okay, just a follow-up question.
Yes, please, Vice Chair Lin.
And I want to make sure the Hynix company located in Eugene yes. continue to grow and yes. profitable. Yes. And could you give us an update how's the company doing compared to previous years? I know it has been good the previous years. What's the prospect of this year or coming years? And also competition from the Taiwan, Korea, and China.
Right.
Are we in a good position?
Yes. We're a relatively quiet company. Kinex used to be called Hyundai, and when it first arrived Eugene, and Phil Barnhart and Paul Halvey in particular will know the history behind the company. But there were high-tech companies. Hynix has done extremely well. Out of nowhere, Hynix has become the second largest in the world. And the future looks extremely bright for this company. And the Oregon workforce played a significant role in making sure that we're staying competitive. The company has taken some risks and been very successful, especially in a field called NAND flash. NAND flash are these particular type of memories that go into iPods. And the company took some risks with that by going in the market early on, and it turned out to be a good decision. And so I think the company is future's extremely bright, and I think there's some growing pains, but I think this company will continue to stay in Oregon for the foreseeable future, and I see it as being a good corporate citizen in this state. And that's all I have to say on that issue.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Representative Barnhart.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to note one of the points you made in response to Representative Riley's question was the workforce was very important. I recall that when I was on the Eugene School Board, we received a letter from the developer, the first manager of the fab in Eugene, complimenting us and the and Lane Community College and other workforce development agencies on the quality of the workforce in the area. They apparently hired a lot more people locally than they had originally expected to
that's
be
correct.
Able to do.
Right.
And that's an indication that the order in which you presented things today, I think, fits with what my recollection is. My question is a technical one.
Yeah.
In the last few days, there have been announcements from Intel and from IBM about hafnium-based chips that would significantly change the architecture for central processors. I wonder, I'm asking a question because I have no idea what the answer is. I wonder if that kind of technology is likely to affect memory chips anytime soon and whether that affects the prospects of your business.
Well, that's a good question. Intel makes microprocessors, and so they're not direct competitors to us. But we have to follow their lead in order to know what the future is going to look like and design our products with that in mind. Otherwise, it just wouldn't work. The whole system wouldn't work. We have anticipated those changes, and we feel that we're positioned very strongly to continue to make cutting-edge memory that fits the new system that's coming on board. Our folks are pretty bright with that. You have to know how the world's going to change down the road in order to compete. And our folks are pretty competitive, and they tend to stay on top of those issues. There's a lot of rumors about a lot of issues related to memory. But I think you can count on Hynix to stay on the very cutting edge and to make products that's going to be relevant to the changing IT world. And so we have no concerns about that particular issue.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Bob, you're representing a very large international company that has chosen the United States. And with the benefit of that perspective, could you perhaps detail for us some things that we as the state of Oregon might be able to do to enhance the competitiveness of some of our domestic industries that might be looking at market expansion, perhaps, say, in the Asian and Pacific Rim countries?
Boy, that's a tough question. We get asked, actually I get asked by wine industry quite a bit, and about not being able to penetrate South Korea in particular. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm not an expert in this field, Chairman, and my advice to you is not going to be, I'm not sure if it's going to add a whole lot of value. I'm on the marketing side of the world, and so I'm a little biased. I think branding certainly plays a huge role in Korea. In South Korea, branding is the market tends to be extremely sensitive to strong brands, and I know that's a factor, but I'm not an expert in this field, and I'm not sure if I'll be able to add any values to your discussion on that particular question.
All right, thank you very much.
I just want to make one comment.
Yes, please, Representative.
And Hynix is a very important company, not only in Eugene, but in our state and in America also. And I just want to thank you for the presence of Hynix.
Sure.
And then they contributed $100,000 to the Korean War Memorial, which was built in the Wilsonville area some about 5 years ago. And also Mr. Peck, the president of that company, is a national leader in this area. So I just want to commend that and put in the record of it.
Thank you so very, very much, Vice Chair Lim. Representative Polvey.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Bobby, I just wanted to say thanks for coming up, and good to have you
thank
up
you.
Here again, and look forward to talking more with you.
Absolutely. Thank you.
Bobby, thank you so much for your wonderful testimony. I hope you enjoyed your return to the committee. I know that we certainly have benefited from your being a witness here today. And a thank you on behalf of our entire committee for the good corporate citizenship that Hynix has exemplified here in the Eugene community. Thank you so very much.
Thank you, Chairman. Thank you, Quinn.
Our last panel will be from the Pacific Northwest Economic Region, Joy Holland, Program Manager, and Neil Pariah, Policy and Communications Director. Good morning to both of you.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Welcome, and if you would, before you begin your testimony, if you would individually introduce yourselves.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, Vice Chairmen, members of the committee. My name is Neil Parekh, and I'm the Policy and Communications Director for the Pacific Northwest Economic Region.
And I'm Joy Howland, Program Manager of the Pacific Northwest Innovation Network for PENWR.
Good morning.
To begin with, what I will do is, first, thank you for the opportunity to visit with the committee. It was a pleasure to return to Salem. The last time I was here was before Representative Lim's committee in the interim session. So thank you for having us back down here. And what I will do is give a little overview of PENWR, of the organization itself, and mention a few of our program areas. And then I will turn it over to Joy to talk about our initiatives in workforce development and high technology. There is a presentation in front of you. I'll just make a few quick highlights, and you can use that for reference later for review. The Pacific Northwest Economic Region is a nonprofit that was created by statute in 1991. Oregon is one of the member jurisdictions. The others are Idaho, Washington, Montana, and then Alberta, British Columbia, Yukon, and Alaska. And that's really the unique nature of PENWR, in that it's a bi-national organization that brings together both the public sector, the legislators and government agencies, and the private sector, the engines of economic growth throughout our region. It is bipartisan in nature, Representative Holvey is one of our is on our delegate council, and we're happy to have him serve in that capacity. We also have Senator David Nelson, who is from the Senate, a leading member of the organization. So it's not only bicameral, but also bipartisan. Bob Repine with the Oregon Economic Development has also been a very active member and active supporter of PennWare. 2 weeks ago, we had a delegation come to Salem, our leadership, who is the president this year is the Minister of Economic Development from the Yukon. We have a vice president from Alaska and from Idaho, and one from British Columbia as well. They met with the governor, they met with the speaker, they met with several committees to talk about a whole range of different issues. PennWare is not is a broad legislative organization. Their leadership are your colleagues from throughout the region. We work on homeland security, transportation, tourism, energy, and workforce development and high tech that, as Joy will mention later. One of the important hallmarks of PennWare is that it's about relationship building around the region and cross-border in order to move forward on issues like pandemic preparedness. We held an exercise recently, which is going to be a big issue for workforce planning. If there is an outbreak, there are going to be high infection rates. People will be asked to stay home. What will that do to critical infrastructures? Will we be able to keep energy flowing? Will we be able to keep information technology, you know, telecommunications going if people can't go out to repair lines, et cetera? So that's one thing that we're looking at. Another issue is with energy. We have a binational energy planning initiative that Representative Holvey is familiar with. One of the things that we're looking at is what are the workforce needs for the entire region with some of the major energy infrastructure projects, particularly in Alberta. They have the oil sands, which are seen as competitors to Saudi Arabia in terms of the potential for oil development. But their big concern is the shortage of skilled workers. Whenever anyone from Alberta is testifying around the region, they always say, if you know how to use a wrench, we'll hire you and bring you back with us, because they're that desperate. That's one issue that we're looking at. And another issue is tourism. We're very involved with the 2010 Olympics, seeing it as an opportunity for the entire region, the entire Pacific Northwest. And one of the things that we are working on is a effort to have foreign teams train in the region in advance of the Olympics. And so we've worked together with several states, Alaska and Idaho and Washington, to establish a initiative to market the region before the games, 2 years out, so that teams will come train here. And Idaho had a great experience with the Salt Lake City Games several years ago. They invested $1 million in their marketing effort, in their infrastructure effort, and saw a return of $100 million in their Olympic planning and Olympic effort. And each state within this region that wants to participate in this effort for the 2010 Olympics, the entry fee is much lower than that. It's a $50,000 investment to be part of this training venues database that we're putting together. And that's going to have an incredible impact on local communities throughout the region who have venues to offer the world's snow and ski teams. The two other issues that we were going to discuss, as I mentioned, are specific initiatives in workforce development and high technology. And for that, I'll hand it over to my colleague, Joy Howland.
My two favorite areas, high technology and workforce development. In looking at international trade with Canada and between Canada, United States, and internationally, I look for the opportunities. What aren't we grabbing? What can we grab to improve worker situation, improve innovation, improve student learning, worker retraining? So we've begun two initiatives, one of which is a high technology focused initiative to bring two very important issues to a regional forum. The first being research and development, and the second being small business sustainability and entrepreneurship. So in looking at that Everyone, actually almost every state and province in our jurisdiction has published a report detailing their commitment to innovation in science and technology. And there's a lot of great ideas contained in these reports. And there's a lot of great ideas around the world. We're competing with China and India in our innovation capacities. And so what we want to do is elevate this dialogue to a regional forum, one in which funding doesn't play a role. There's not two universities or two research organizations competing for state funds. It is a forum of regional stakeholders to discuss what are best practices and how can we bring them or adopt them in the region or within our individual states and provinces. So we're forming a regional task force that will consist of members of each jurisdiction, state, and province to begin this discussion. We're also creating an IT infrastructure that will assist in facilitating some of these discussions, as well as help universities and research organizations from around the U.S. states by adopting a Canadian platform that was developed by University of British Columbia called Flintbox. Flintbox has been in operation for 3 years up in Canada, being utilized by 61 Canadian research organizations and institutions. And so we want to, Penware is going to become a channel partner for Flintbox in the U.S. region of our territory that will enable essentially researcher, faculty, research organizations to go online, post their research or associate products to find matches, people that might be interested in collaborating with them, to juxtapose research ideas and see if the new synergy or a new Google occurs. I saw in the Business Innovation Plan that the U.S. Economic Development Administration, who has also supported this initial effort in Washington State, is also funded Oregon to create a venture capital angel online infrastructure as well. So you see where these synergies are starting to come together, where we need an IT infrastructure so we can share information and promote and brand our region as a high-tech innovator, as well as discuss how we can leverage these solutions across the region. The second issue is our workforce development. As Neil has indicated, that energy and the 2010 Olympics are creating a very high workforce demand in both the provinces of British Columbia and Alberta. And Penware has recently received a grant from the Canadian government to investigate impediments or barriers to worker mobility between the United States and Canada to supply those projects. Putting that in context of Oregon and Washington and Idaho, what does that mean? We have our own shortages of skilled workers, specifically in the skilled trades. So there is some investigation on whether or not we have the workers. But there's a side benefit to that as well, that when we talk about increasing capacity of our education providers to produce more engineers, carpenters, welders, plumbers, you name it, that there's concern about vulnerability of that workforce. You know, projects are often cyclical. They have stints of unemployment and rely on the workforce investment system to get them retrained or back into work or connected with an employer, or on their own ingenuity are moving or relocating to find a more permanent job. So I look at the worker mobility study as possibly a way to look at how we can sustain workforce in the region and keep people here transitioning through projects and support our own state's infrastructure needs, as well as seize the opportunities in Canada as well. So that will close and open to questions.
Thank you very much. Questions for our panel. Yes, Vice Chair Lim.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I understand that the membership fee from our state about $50,000 in biennium.
To clarify that, I apologize for the confusion. What I should have mentioned in terms of the organization as a whole, each member state and province pays dues on an annual basis. Those dues are $35,000 per year. To support the general organization in terms of the operating expenses. Then on top of that, when we have certain initiatives, I was referring to the tourism initiative that we have in terms of finding training venues. We have an energy initiative. Individual jurisdictions have the choice to participate in that project or not. So for example, on the tourism initiative, to participate in that online venues database, that would be an additional $50,000 per year. And Alaska, Washington, Idaho, and Alberta have actually participated in that. And when we market our region as a destination, as a potential for training venues, the reality is that those jurisdictions that are participating in that program will get the preference in terms of the marketing exposure. Okay. Oregon is not yet a participant in that program.
Okay. Please. Since we are giving at least $50,000, and what are we getting out of it? And then could you give me one example?
And I remember discussing this topic with you last time when I was here with the committee. I think that Representative Holvey spoke to that last time in terms of talking about the exposure that Oregon is having with the neighboring states and jurisdictions on various projects that are going on. So, for example, with the Northern Lights project. This is a major infrastructure project that is being proposed from Alberta and or Montana in terms of which specific route they choose to build a high-voltage DC line all the way through to Vegas and Southern California. Having the energy chairs of each region be able to share information about that project and be able to interact with the developers to make sure that either A, the route goes through an appropriate place through the state and avoids wilderness areas is something that we think is very important. It's an opportunity to be at the table when policymaking is being discussed that will affect Oregon. It allows you to participate in the process.
Okay. Thank you.
Representative Holvey.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I just follow up with Neil's comments and perhaps shed a little more light on the economic interest that's being served for the state of Oregon. You will remember we had the Canadian Softwood Lumber Agreement, which is very important to our timber industry on the amount of lumber that's imported into Oregon. Pinwar was very much involved in the solution to that agreement, and as well, they're also seeing that this region is wholly containing the Columbia River system. The negotiations are about the amount of water that is available to Oregon, which has huge economic impacts. That policy is also at play with Pinwar in discussions and relationships and negotiations with our Canadian counterparts. So those are very huge economic discussions that the solutions to those discussions have vast and huge economic impacts, much less the ability to have some of our trade issues that the chair was speaking about, of being able to inspect boxcars where they're loaded and where they're taken out instead of stopping them at the border, is also an extremely important thing that Pinwar is also involved in discussing that with our federal government. So these are very high-level discussions that have national implications and huge economic implications to our region.
Thank you very much, Representative Holvey, and thank you both very much for your work on those issues. I was on a recent trip to Canada, and I heard from both provincial and federal government officials there the very serious labor shortage that Canada faces, probably significantly more severe than we're facing here in the United States, and we have acknowledged a veritable train wreck facing us probably a decade to 15 years out. I was shocked to learn that the labor shortage in Canada is so severe that at least in interior BC and parts of Alberta, it is not uncommon to find fast food industry workers being paid $20 an hour, that this is common standard, and still very severe labor shortages. Given the fact that wages alone are not enough to find an adequate labor supply, how do we attract enough workers into a pipeline to be able to skill these workers up for the demands that our employers are going to be needing throughout the Pacific Northwest? And I suspect that we probably need to be viewing our labor force as a workforce shed. In other words, it is international. We are going to be facing increasingly international demands for a labor supply. How do we get the people in the pipeline?
Well, I think that there's two parts to that question. Many industries are suffering labor shortage or projecting to deal with labor shortage due to baby boom retirements and simply like in the IT sector, the outsourcing trend has diminished the appeal of becoming a software engineer or programmer. So I think that providing information on, we can look at business trends. We can project out based on business trends where their demand in labor is going to be. Occupational data is only helpful to a certain point. And so our educators and our industry partners need to work together to communicate where their businesses are going and where they see potential shortages, because occupational labor market data can't keep up with the pace of industry. So I think that we really need to be proactive in that. I keep going back to industry as well. I mean, if there is shortages that are going to adversely impact their business model, that they should be at the table talking to high school students, presenting, making them aware of the opportunities, the wages, in their industry and in specific occupations. There's also an interesting element to the labor shortage in Alberta, more specifically, is that they cannot attract enough workers to the province of Alberta. And so that presents a unique opportunity for the states in the U.S. and specifically the Pacific Northwest to move to enhance their manufacturing capabilities here in Oregon. So instead of saying, I need Oregon workers to go to Alberta and then return to Oregon to work on infrastructure projects, we need to look at more of a systems integration approach to how that work is handled in Alberta and look at where the opportunities, where our capacities are in the U.S., in neighboring states, to supply that industry with parts. So we're talking about some manufacturing jobs going away, but there certainly are manufacturing jobs and high-value jobs that are coming to the forefront, and we need to have the vision enough and the feedback loop enough, which Penwer and also helps facilitate and create that feedback loop in so that we can proactively look at where those opportunities are and seize them. So looking at retirements, looking at business trends, looking for opportunities that are created for international trade, and communicating the message, I think, is our biggest challenge. We need to let our students know, and parents and counselors, where these opportunities are and what a job in IT or a welder really is like, and let those children make up their own minds and provide the educational pathways to do so.
Thank you. Yes.
If I may add to that, Mr. Chairman, there is a real tangible opportunity for Oregon in this area. We've worked with the Canadian Manufacturing Association and the Canadian Association of Petroleum Producers to explore this possibility, and we are actually expecting a proposal at our annual summit in Anchorage this year in July. What they're looking for is how can they, as Joy mentioned, get partners in the other states and jurisdictions from within the region to handle the manufacturing outside of Alberta and then ship it up. The big reason is because not only do they have a major workforce shortage, but at the same time, they can't handle the influx of workers that they already have. They're having difficulty. You mentioned the fast food workers. They have difficulty having enough teachers, having enough hospital infrastructure, having enough housing. It's actually, the growth has been so tremendous up there that in some ways they would prefer it if some of the manufacturing could be handled outside of Alberta, similar to what Boeing is doing with the 77, mm-hmm. Building a part in Japan and moving it over by ship, etc. They're actively looking at those kinds of opportunities, and that's something that we hope Oregon would be able to participate in the next few years, and that way it won't affect workforce issues within the state in terms of the needs that you might have.
Thank you. Anyone else? Yes, Representative Gerard.
Just a brief comment. I actually had the privilege of living in Canada for 9 years in British Columbia. And one of the things that I absolutely noticed was that on the Northwest, we have a lot more in common with British Columbia and Alberta, and I live in Boston too, than we do in Boston. But what's really stark is if you live in Canada, the commonality between British Columbia and, say, Ontario and Quebec, we have a lot more in common. So I applaud organizations like this. Tend to have the same economies, and by that we can market worldwide. I just think it's good to keep our hand in it. But I also must comment one thing. Canadians don't always seem to respect Americans very much, and having lived up there, that was always a problem. Has that waned at all? Or
Being Canadian, I respect you very much. I think that's fundamentally changed. I mean, I don't think it's a lack of respect. I think what Penward brings to the table is an understanding of common ground and an understanding of our difference culturally. I mean, we talk about the differences between Asian cultures and the United States. There are differences in perspective and cultures between the United States and Canada that we must recognize, but also be able to turn those differences into opportunities. I mean, Canadians think of things a little bit different. Their government system is very different from ours. Their investments in education are different from ours, and so there are lessons on both sides, whereas Canadians admire U.S. ingenuity and entrepreneurship and risk, and so by blending the two, I think that we can find a common ground that will move us both forward in a productive and proactive manner.
I'd like to echo the representative remarks. I'm actually from New York myself originally. I won't hold that. Hopefully you're not a Red Sox fan, representative. But we always like to say that, you know, we have more in common with Western Canada than we do with the East Coast, with Washington, D.C., New York, or Ottawa. And that really does hold true in terms of the way we approach you know, regional issues, the example being the 2010 Olympics. We worked, and I believe Oregon was one of the states that passed a resolution endorsing Vancouver's bid to host the 2010 Olympics. We had all the other states and provinces do the same, and that actually raised some ire on the East Coast among people from New York. They were wondering why were we supporting Canada's bid for the Olympics if that might hurt New York's chances for the 2012 Olympics. And we answered in much the way, same way that Representative Gerard did, that we have more in common with British Columbia than we do with you.
Certainly.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Representative Gerard and Joy and Neil, thank you, the three of you, for underscoring the importance, I think, Joy, first of industry-wide solutions, and then the three of you of regional and international solutions. These problems are bigger than Oregon, and the solutions will need to be also. And I know that you will find Oregon a very willing partner in that regard. Please feel free to call on us if there's any assistance that we can provide. Thank you for your very good work, and thank you for your excellent testimony.
We appreciate
thank you.
It. Thank you, Chair.
Any further comments from the committee? Ellen, would you give us a preview, please, of Wednesday's hearing?
On Wednesday, January 31st, the committee will be hearing House Bill 2279, which corrects the name of the fund from which net receipts of video lottery games are transferred to counties. House Bill 2447, which declares January 13th of each year to be Korean American Day, and its companion joint resolution number 12, which encourages Oregonians to join in the celebration of Korean American Day, and House Bill 2449, which designates the Columbia Gorge Discovery Center as the Oregon Ice Age Museum.
Thank you again to everyone who's appeared, not only today, but in the past informational sessions. Certainly appreciate the interests of our live as well as our internet audience. With that, our committee stands adjourned until Wednesday.